How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
Welcome to Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton. Today we're plugging into the country's clean energy markets and how they are funded. Renewable power has been growing quickly and now accounts for one-fifth of electricity generated worldwide, according to the International Energy Agency. Getting away from fossil fuels for transportation has been a tougher slog. Batteries for electric cars remain expensive, and biofuels using inputs that don't compete with food have been slow to develop. Yet looking at the recent freak weather, biblical floods, epic droughts, fires, melting ice caps, the imperative of delinking carbon pollution from economic growth is stronger than ever. Over the next hour, we'll discuss financing and building a clean energy future with our live audience here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. We're pleased to be joined by three experts. John Bond is CEO of the Renewable Energy Trust. He also is a former CEO of Moody's Investor Services and a former chairman and CEO of the Export-Import Bank of the United States. Dennis McGinn is president of the American Council on Renewable Energy in Washington, D.C. He is a retired vice admiral in the United States Navy, where he commanded the 3rd Fleet in the North Pacific. Should also mention he's a member of the Climate One Advisory Council. Clint Wilder is author of Clean Tech Nation, How the U.S. Can Lead in the New Global Economy, and is a senior editor at Clean Edge, a research and global online publishing firm. Please welcome them to Climate One. Admiral McGinn, let's begin with you. I know you're a grandfather, so if you were to characterize the clean energy economy, would it be an Olympic athlete in tip-top physical condition? Would it be an adolescent kind of finding its way and identity in the world? Or would it be a toddler just learning how to go from crawling to walking?
I'd say somewhere between a toddler and an adolescent, maybe third or fourth grade. But speaking about toddlers, I want to go back to what you said about some of the things that are happening. About 2 weeks ago, I was in Denver with one of my granddaughters, 2.5 years old. We're at the Denver Zoo. And as we're walking those wonderful pathways, seeing these terrific animals, well cared for, it suddenly occurred to me, am I ever glad that Noah believed in climate change? And not only that, but he had a nice adaptation strategy. And if he hadn't done that, we wouldn't be at the zoo seeing all those wonderful animals.
Great. Well, John Bond, is there enough money for clean energy investments and they're just looking for the right projects and matching up, or is there not enough money getting into the system for clean energy?
Two different questions. There's plenty of money around looking for ways to get into the clean tech business. The problem is that it's, if you like, messed up because there is an intersection between the regulatory process and the investment process. Much of what has happened over the last few years is a creature of government. It's a creature of policy. It's a creature of wannabe. It's the normative approach to the world. We want to be clean tech. We want to have, we're concerned about climate change. We're worried about all of that stuff. And therefore, as a matter of government policy, we have created all these incentives. What the government gives, the government also takes away. And money is nervous. It goes where it's welcome. So we have, on the one hand, a whole series of important incentives moving us in the clean tech direction. At the same time, there's a basic distrust of relying on government policy when you're investing money. And that's the big dilemma that's going on now. If you have an incentive that is a 1 or 2 year incentive, or if something's going to change, or if the debate gets into the political arena, particularly the partisan arena, money just says, well, we'll wait till this gets sorted out. So part of it's a question of structure, but part of it's this struggle for clarity on the part of investors.
So we have a third grader with lots of money in their pockets. That's what we've got so far. Clint Wilder, you want to comment on that in terms of the inevitability of this? There's money waiting on the sidelines.
Yeah, there is. I want to go back to, Greg, what you said at the beginning about delinking carbon pollution and economic growth. That's sort of, at Clean Edge and in our book, Clean Tech Nation, we kind of spin that around and say developing clean tech, non-carbon or less carbon technologies, is critical to economic growth for our nation or any nation as we move forward. So it's this false choice of environment versus economy. We're still fighting it in the political and partisan arena for sure, but that's we're kind of on the bandwagon to try and say, look, these are the critical industries of this century, the nations and companies and regions that lead them are going to be economic leaders as well as moving clean tech forward. So having said that, I think there is a lot of money on the sidelines, as John was just saying, in the political season. There's a lot of wait and see, but we think there are a lot of potential new innovations in financing, both public, private, or a combination of the two, that can really move this forward. And I think we'll probably get into some of that in the discussion.
Well, if I could comment, Greg, briefly on something that Clint touched on, and that is, I think behind the psychology of those who would deny climate change or doubt it seriously is this belief that it's a zero-sum game. I can either have a healthy environment locally, regionally, or globally, or I can have a good quality of life and environment, especially in this country. And the fact of the matter is that you can have it both ways. In fact, it's a triple win, because it's a win for the environment, it's a win for the economy, and it's a win for quality of life. And we're proving this in the investments and the growth in renewable energy. Everybody loves electricity, but not too many people want to live 5 miles downwind from a coal-fired power plant. But we're saying there are alternatives. We can still have all the electricity we need used wisely and efficiently, but we can get it in ways that we couldn't before because of the scale-up of renewable energy.
And let's talk about where some of that growth and that generation is happening. Alaska has seen green jobs, and I'm not sure exactly how they define green jobs. Sometimes that's very expansively. A person who drives a bus powered by natural gas is sometimes considered a green job. But Alaska's green jobs went up 98% from 8,000 to 16,000. Wyoming, 53% from 4,000 to 6,000. Nebraska from 10,000 to 15,000. These are red states with real job growth because of clean energy. And yet we don't seem to hear about that in our political debate, which makes us think that if you listen to the national political debate, you wouldn't think that there's real green jobs in red states. John Bond?
Well, I think that's fair. Again, going back to this partisan exercise, you have two circumstances. One, you have the debacle of Wall Street 2008, which has created monumental distrust, as far as the people are concerned, with Wall Street, financial techniques, investment bankers, all of that. There is a real, if you want, antagonism out there to money sources, people who are playing in the money business. The second part of it is even more, I think, troublesome. The parties, particularly the Democrats and the Republicans, have talked themselves into this either-or thing that Dennis was talking about. You can't have real environmental protection, because what it'll do, it's a matter of national security, it's all of those kinds of things. And the answer, I think, is, hopefully we'll get to this when the political season is over, I think the answer is different. I think the answer is you can have both. But what we fail to focus on is the time element. You can't get there from here in a decade or two. These are huge transformational forces. You've got our own national security. You're talking about you need affordable, reliable energy. So the debate says, well, we can't have that if it's just renewables. True enough, there will always be a place for, in my judgment, combined cycle engines and all of that kind of thing. But our task is not to go from A to B instantly. Our task is to modulate that transition over a couple of decades so we preserve the good part of our electrical system and our power generation, at the same time moving to a better part and an increasing contribution from that part. That's the time thing that's the problem.
on the green jobs in red states that you were talking about, that is absolutely happening. And there, I think there's no better example than the wind power industry, where you see, if you take the debate out of the inside the beltway, you know, the Capitol Hill fights, and you look at the number of Republican governors who are supporting this critical incentive for wind called the production tax credit, which is in jeopardy right now. So they're differing from their party and their party's presidential candidate on this issue. But the governors of Kansas, Iowa, North Dakota, so on down the line, they know what the wind power industry means to their states. Iowa is the second most productive wind state behind Texas, another red state. South Dakota, which has a smaller overall energy demand, gets 22% of its all its electricity from the wind. So again, as I say, this is not about tree hugging and Birkenstocks. These are real jobs, often both installing but also manufacturing the wind components. So, you know, the kind of the at least politically the holy grail of American manufacturing jobs. The wind power industry is making that happen, and almost all of it is in these red states.
This third or fourth grader we're calling the clean energy economy transition, you know, knocks things over and creates a little turbulence. And John is exactly right. It's not whether a question of if, it's a question of when and how fast. And we've got to try to figure out ways, the right kinds of policies, investments, technologies that that try to smooth out that transition, that turbulence. But there'll always be turbulence, and change usually doesn't have a big constituency. My wife has a wonderful cross-stitch sampler that says, when God closes one door, he always opens another. It's just hell in the hallway. And the hell in the hallway is this turbulence of change going from what has been a very, very vibrant economy, has made the United States the world leader, based on, in large measure, fossil fuel. And we are going to a clean economy. We're just looking for that next door to open a little wider.
And Admiral McGinn, you head a national association based in Washington. Are these state voices heard in Washington, these governors, where the job growth is happening, or does that just get lost in the mud and the muck and the swamp of Washington?
No, I think it really is being listened to in various ways. You don't hear that in public pronouncements because of the campaign season and the rhetorical firebombs that are being thrown. But I think that quietly to key members of energy committees or perhaps tax committees, especially given the gravitas of a governor that is seeing the benefits of wind energy or solar energy or any other form of renewable energy, saying to a chairman or certainly to their state, their delegations in Congress that represent their states, we really, really need to continue the production tax credit, for example. We're losing jobs, and we'll continue to lose jobs until we have some sort of stability. The stability that John mentioned about, you really do need to create long-term visionary policy that invites money or creates market certainty so that it lowers the reality and the perception of risk in the minds of investors. And the frustrating thing is there's literally tens of billions of dollars of investment capital that are waiting on the sidelines looking for the right opportunity to invest in this clean energy economy, but they're so afraid in many cases that government policy will pull the rug out from under them by changing a mandate or changing a tax policy or changing some other aspect of government involvement.
We had Jim Rogers, CEO of Duke Energy, here say that the political cycles are 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, and yet investment cycles for energy are 20 years, 40 years, 60
right.
years.
That's
so the
exactly
capital
right.
cycles and the political cycles don't line up no matter who's in power.
Right.
So that's
exactly
a structural impediment to getting this thing done, John Barr.
It's got partly to do with that, but it's got also partly to do with this, I would argue, futile search for a national energy policy. We spent a lot of time and a lot of rhetoric and a lot of money trying to develop a national energy policy. The real policy leadership has come from the states, to Clint's point, and a lot of it has come from people like Mike Peavy at the PUC here in California. At the same time we move forward in this policy in the area of renewable portfolio standards and all the kinds of things that give renewable incentives and the industry to build and develop, at the same time we in California have empowered everybody to stop everything. So what we have is, on the one hand, the policy initiatives that are moving forward, I think, principally again at the state level, but in this excessive democracy, if you like, and are out of a real concern that something might go wrong, it costs a lot of money to do simple tasks in California in pursuit of renewable energy.
Sounds like you're supporting Governor Brown's proposal to revise the California Environmental Quality Act.
Well, yes, indeed, and I hate to say that as a card-carrying Republican, but the answer is yes. What we have done is to create the ability of people to abuse what is a truly, I think, innovative and important piece of legislation. And the abuse takes the form in the reluctance of trial judges to dismiss frivolous complaints. You can almost always get a Superior Court judge to let the complaint be heard, which stops everything, which costs the developers money. And years go by with frivolous attacks on a project, and there is no mechanism by which you can resolve the issues in a reasonable amount of time. There's a lot of money that's around and has been spent in wasted time. The Environmental Act is an important piece of legislation. It's been badly abused, continues to be badly abused, and the problem is you can't ever get final resolution so that you can do something.
It sounds to me like we need a cap and trade program. We need to put a cap on the number of graduates of law schools and trade them into electrical engineers.
Try getting that through a legislature full of lawyers, but okay. Clint Wilder?
Yeah, well, as a card-carrying environmentalist, I'm going to agree with John on this.
Should I back out of the way?
and because this conflict, I think, you know, what we're referring to is siting solar plants or wind farms in possibly sensitive habitat areas and that kind of thing, where you actually have the traditional environmentalist community and the clean tech development community often at odds. And I think you need to step back and look at the big picture. I mean, if we're talking about a big solar plant that can replace many, many megawatts of fossil fuel power to make some impact on reducing carbon emissions. I mean, if we don't get carbon under control, there isn't going to be good habitat for any species. So, you know, I think that we have to, like, transform these debates of the past of, oh, it's a big project, we as environmentalists need to oppose it, and then look at that big picture on the entire environment of the planet.
Let's talk about natural gas, which is changing the energy landscape for both renewables, nuclear, coal, everything. How is that cheap natural gas, which today is under $3 per million BTU? No one expects it to stay there, but everyone's kind of anxious. It could go lower. Let's talk about how that's impacting. Is it really pulling the rug under renewables? You, John Bond, you said earlier you thought maybe the government would do it. Cheap natural gas is doing just as much to undercut energy there.
I think that's right. We got lucky in this one. We suddenly discovered that we have all this natural gas, and the market has not yet had a chance to equilibrate. We will, I suspect, in the not-too-distant future, begin to export natural gas. The global markets will begin to equilibrate, and the price of natural gas will go up. I don't know. I've heard estimates from $4 to $6 as a kind of a stability figure. You know,
in Asia, it's in the high teens, mid-teens.
Yeah. So you can see the draw of exporting natural gas to places like Asia. It is impeding, if you want, the renewable development. It slowed it down some because people are asking the same kinds of questions that you were asking. Nonetheless, I think we've passed the stage where certainly the people of the state of California, but I would argue the people in the United States, we've passed the stage where the question is, should we do renewables, should we not do renewables? It's really now, what kind of renewables, how fast can we do it, and do we, and to what extent, do we need government support? Because at the end of the day, government support is taking the money out of one taxpayer and giving it to somebody else.
John Bond is the CEO of Renewable Energy Trust. Our other guests today at Climate One are Dennis McGinn, President of the American Council on Renewable Energy, and Clint Wilder, author of Clean Tech Nation. I'm Greg Dalton. Admiral McGinn, you're head of an organization for renewable energy. Natural gas is not renewable. It's a fossil fuel. Do you
Right.
support development of natural gas, even though it's cleaner than coal?
I do, to a point. It ought to really be the transition fuel that we always envisioned it to be. It's certainly got a lower greenhouse gas footprint significantly than coal. And I think it can operate in a very synergistic way with renewable energy. It can come on and off in terms of firming electrical power much more quickly than coal-fired or even nuclear plants. That you have to effectively boil water, turn it to steam, and it takes a while to heat it up and cool it down. But you can dispatch natural gas produced electricity a lot faster, and that's good for dealing with intermittency issues with wind or solar, for example. On the other side of it, you have this wonderful cost of fuel for renewables, which is effectively zero, that is a great hedge about any type of price volatility or inevitable price rise over the next 5, 10, 20 years. So if you put yourself in the position of a regulator or a regulated utility, you know, I don't think too many of them are going to make a bet for a power purchase agreement of 20 years that we're going to see sub $5 an MCF gas prices for that whole time. So it's nice to have this synergistic mix where you do have a hedge. The other, I guess, in addition to the likely export of natural gas that's going to drive up the cost is that we are converting to from coal to natural gas for power production. In the Northeast, we're seeing a conversion from home heating oil to natural gas. The price differential on a BTU to BTU basis is 6-1, so it really makes a lot of economic sense to do that. We're going to see a slight increase in the cost of producing and delivering natural gas because of concerns about methane leaks, for example. The water challenge of hydraulic fracturing is significant, especially in the western part of the United States. And there's some infrastructure things to be dealt with in terms of gas pipelines. The tragedy in December of 2010 down in San Bruno is an example of we need to make sure that we are making investments in this commodities distribution. But bottom line, I believe that natural gas and renewables can, in fact, help each other and help us all in terms of delivering cleaner power than what our present portfolio is, and to do it in a much less expensive way.
But as a bridge to the future, how long is that bridge? Once companies and states put a lot of infrastructure into natural gas, it's hard to get off that bridge when you got jobs and capital that are
right.
invested in what is then the status quo.
Right.
So some have said that's a bridge to nowhere, or if
sure.
it, you know, Clint Wilder.
But,
or,
but as Admiral McGinn was saying, they really do pair well together. So with Clean Edge, we really see natural gas and renewables growing together for a while. And for example, I think the largest natural gas plant in Florida by FPL has a big solar component as well. So that kind of solar shines during the day, and then the natural gas is on as well, but fills in where the solar can't produce.
I've visited that plant
yeah.
in Florida, and it's exactly what it does. It mm-hmm. Basically, you have the option of best value, least cost choices. And we're starting to see this as we start to get microgrids of what are effectively the so-called smart grid, where you have multiple sources of power generation on a grid. You can make choices about is the sun shining, the wind blowing, is the biomass producing, or do we need to use natural gas or another form of electricity. And you can also do better balancing of load versus the power generation to manage load in a way that doesn't affect quality of life or economic productivity.
And another thing about that I've noticed since the natural gas boom, if you will, it seems to have knocked out most of this conversation about clean coal, which I think is a good thing, because the clean coal technology is just not there at all today. And it was kind of a pipe dream to to preserve the coal industry that I don't think makes sense.
When I was a young guy coming up, still believed in Santa Claus. Actually, I still do. But if you weren't a good kid, you got a lump of coal in your Christmas stocking.
Yeah, right.
What kind of message was that?
I mean, I think one has to recognize that the traditional structure of the public utility is both part of the solution and part of the problem. It's part of the solution because, at least in California, they have been directed to buy and encourage, through the renewable portfolio standard others, to encourage investment in renewable energy. They've got percentage limitations that they have to meet by certain times. They're also part of the problem because it is a traditionally centrally directed, monolithic sort of structure. And it is largely the utilities that have a monopoly, in addition to delivering electricity, in producing PPAs that permit people to develop solar energy or wind energy.
Those are power purchase agreements.
Power purchase agreements. So on the one hand, you have the utility, which is pulling the renewable industry. On the other hand, you've given them the power to sort of dictate the terms on which that will take place. We're working our way through a change in the utility model from what it has been traditionally to, among other things, the thing that Dennis was referring to, a series of microgrids, a series of distributed generation capabilities. That's a tough thing to do when you have billions of dollars of steel in the ground around a model that's worked very well for a number of decades.
Centralized power.
And, well, one area of innovation around that is community choice aggregation, giving people the choice to get their electricity from different places. That's been tried here in San Francisco. It's happening in other places. Is that something you support, more consumer choice in electricity, John Bunn?
Well, I have traditionally been quite skeptical of community choice aggregation. And I've been skeptical not because I don't believe in choice. It's just that I have yet to see the numbers that on an apples-to-apples basis permit the community choice aggregation system to compete honestly with the price at which a public utility can deliver that same power. The jury's out in my mind whether or not
people want to pay more, could they have that choice, just like they can pay more for a Mercedes than a Toyota or something like that?
And they can do that through a utility. The most utilities will say, if you want to pay more, PG&E had a program where you could pay $5 more and get green energy. Green energy is simply an allocation of all of the electrons out there. We're going to say this many of those electrons are green, and we take them from a particular power source, and you get some of those. In actuality, it's simply an allocation process.
Well, I live in Marin County, where we have this. It's called Marin Clean Energy. It's the first large-scale application of the community choice aggregation, and it's been very successful so far. There were three towns that didn't join it at first, and they have subsequently joined it because it seems like a good deal to them. You can pay more if you want, but you're at or in some cases below PG&E prices. And an irony, if you will, is that the provider of clean energy to Marin Clean Energy is actually a division of Shell Oil. But they're aggregating different renewable sources. So I mean, it's proven. It's a much cleaner mix than PG&E offers, but you know, it's still, so it's not just it sounds, community choice sounds like it's going to be a lot of little things, but it's still big energy, but it's clean power sources.
Let's talk about the United States military, which has been a key driver, particularly the Navy Admiral, but there's been some pushback lately. Recently, Secretary of Navy Ray Mabus had a whole carrier group operating on biofuels, but there's some pushback saying, hey, why is the Navy paying so darn much for these fancy fuels? And so talk about that sort of pushback.
Sure.
Against some of their achievement progress.
Well, not just the Navy, but the entire Department of Defense and national security structure. These leaders think over the horizon, beyond the next quarterly earnings report or the next election cycle. Mm-hmm. they're charged with trying to define as best they can the future strategic environment. And what they have concluded is that challenges like climate change and the severe weather that that goes with it, challenges like energy security and the availability of especially petroleum, is going to be a challenge. So what they're starting to do is make investments in technologies that will expand the portfolio of energy choices for both electricity on bases and forward deployed operating bases, as well as for transportation of things that fly in the air, sail on the sea, or move on the ground. And in the case of the Navy, Ray Mabus has been a really visionary leader. He has invested in the testing of drop-in fuels into everything that the Navy operates in terms of equipment, including the F-18 Super Hornet, flying them on 50% blend of biofuel and traditional jet fuel, putting it in ships. And the pushback was, well, gee, this biofuel blend costs a lot more than just putting in regular fossil fuel. True. And the Secretary of the Navy would be the first to tell you that he does not intend to operate the Navy at those elevated levels of fuel purchase prices, but that he wants to create the demand signal there for an industry that is rapidly growing, using a variety of feedstocks, including algae, for example, or camelina, switchgrass, et cetera, and mixing them with great science and technology and coming up with a whole set of products, everything from ethanol to heavy oil that is based on algal oil, algal crude. So the pushback is a very near-term focus. Quickly, historical perspective, every time the Navy has shifted from one propulsion fuel to another, there's been pushback, and it always is the same thing. You can change the names of the members of Congress and the name of the fuel, but going from sail to steam, from wood to coal, from coal to oil, from oil to nuclear, now nuclear and oil, to biofuels. And thank goodness that over the years, over the centuries, the Navy has prevailed and said, we've got to think about our operational capability. And that's why not just the Navy, but all of the services are investing in clean energy. It's all about improving their bottom line of operational effectiveness and efficiency, trying to get the most out of every taxpayer dollar that goes to national security.
And there's a mission aspect, lives per gallon.
Absolutely.
Too, which all those
absolutely.
Fuel convoys that go up in flames and
right.
the conflict theater.
Yeah, and in terms of funding, this has actually been one of the big bright spots for the clean tech industry over the past 12 to 18 months. The military is really behind this and has a lot of money to put behind it and to fund emerging technologies. The Department of Defense is the world's largest user of energy. So we're talking, big bucks, and again, and this is as Admiral McGinn was saying, we've always done this. I mean, you know, nuclear submarines weren't as cheap as what they were replacing at the time, and there were naysayers that said, no, that it's too expensive. It probably, you know, we don't know if it's really going to work. So, to have this kind of nickel and diming going on now is disheartening. But again. Historically, the forces of progress usually prevail.
You know,
the point about money in the Department of Defense, one of the things we've talked about at our financial forum right down the street here has been third-party financing, where we bring in some of this private capital that John mentioned earlier and create public-private partnerships with the Navy or Army, Air Force, or Marines to bring some of this good investment into it without having to go through a long process that literally takes 5 or 7 years of setting a requirement for new energy sources for the Department of Defense, running it through the planning, programming, and budgeting system to finally be approved by Congress at some future date. Now the requirement is clear, and the services are partnering with the private sector to do these agreements to get steel in the ground and have the benefits much sooner than we would otherwise if we did the old traditional process.
And one area is also buildings. We've been talking a lot about planes and tanks, et cetera, but also Pentagon military buildings are a big deal. The bases use a lot of energy, and there was some rules saying they have to be LEED certified, et cetera.
Yes.
But even that, there's been some pushback from the industry that doesn't want the government building paying more for LEED buildings, even
right.
though in the long run, they save energy.
They save a lot of energy, and I think we're seeing this intersection, if you will, of the public and private domains. It can create a very, very nice cycle. I call it spin-in and spin-out technology, where the government or the services will go for whatever relevant technology already exists, commercial off the shelf, and bring it in to do things like flexible solar arrays in Afghanistan for patrols. They're not developing them themselves. They're going out there to the recreation and sports industry, and they're seeing some of this, and, hey, it really makes sense for those soldiers and Marines over there in Afghanistan. But also, as Clint pointed out, in the case of nuclear submarines, there's spin-out. We have GPS today that is ubiquitous in our economy and society because the Air Force and Navy invested in it many decades ago for narrow military purposes, but it has benefit. Same thing is true of microchips and the Internet and many other examples of the spin-out. So it's a nice dynamic, public and private investment, public and private partnerships that will help the national security early on and then will have many economic and social benefits down the road.
Dennis McGinn is president of the American Council on Renewable Energy. Our other guests today at Climate One are John Bond, CEO of the Renewable Energy Trust, and Clint Wilder, author of Clean Tech Nation. I'm Greg Dalton. Let's talk about some of the new things that could happen to get more money into clean technology. John Bond, there's something called real estate investment trusts. People might own them in their 401ks, et cetera. It brought a lot of capital where people could own a piece of a hotel or an office building. Doesn't exist yet for clean energy. Is it going to happen?
Well, we think it is, and at the risk of delving into a promotional exercise, Renewable Energy Trust is, at this point, exploring and moving forward to use the renewable energy, the real estate investment trust vehicle to harness that in the service of solar PV. If you look back at the REIT industry has, which started in the 60s, as Greg said, has started out to get a wider participation. People could invest in the real estate market. You didn't have to be a big bank or you didn't have to be a big trust fund. It has evolved over time to be much more flexible vehicle. Our view is that this is the kind of vehicle that will do two important things. Number one, it will provide liquidity in the market. So if people are investing in renewable energy, particularly in our case solar PV, they'll be able to buy and sell. They'll be able to get in and out of the market, so you're not locked in. Now it's impossible really for John Q. Citizen to invest in the renewable sector. You have to either buy a company or one of those kinds of investments. We think this will provide a whole new investor class for renewable, and we think it'll bring a new group that are interested for the kinds of reasons, in addition, that Clint was talking about. People are prepared to invest. They want to invest in this industry, but they need a vehicle. What we did differently than others is we started with the REIT analysis. How do these things work? Let's now figure out how to harness that for the benefit of the solar PV industry. Most people started the other way and got all tangled up in the clouds of trying to figure out how to do that.
There are other mechanisms for bringing more wider spread base of capital into renewable energy. One is master limited partnerships. There's a Master Limited Partnerships Parity Act that was introduced in a bipartisan fashion in both the Senate and the House. The House was just last week, and then
by a very conservative Republican.
Right, exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And so this is yet another tool in the toolbox to try to level the playing field of renewable energy investment. One of the problems we're experiencing right now is, it's a myth that renewable energy can't compete on a cost basis. Well, if you start breaking down, what are the elements cost? You've got material, you've got labor, you've got planning, and you have cost of capital. The cost of capital is artificially high because some of these REITs and master limited partnership mechanisms aren't available to the renewable energy industry. And cost is cost, whether it's cost of capital or cost of labor or material. And we see that the possibility of creating a virtuous cycle where if you can get more capital at a lower cost, it lowers the cost of delivered renewable energy, which causes scale up and a reduction in the cost of the technology and material. And it really, really invites more and more. It accelerates that transition to the clean energy economy.
And we should say that these vehicles, master limited partnerships, have been one of the key vehicles for funding oil and gas exploration
exactly.
and development in this country.
Right.
Well,
yeah. So the final chapter of Clean Tech Nation is called a 7-point action plan for repowering America. And two of the 7 points have to do with investment vehicles. One is exactly what these gentlemen have been talking about, adapting master limited partnerships and REITs to the renewable energy space. And the other is create a national green infrastructure bank. And there's legislation has been introduced to do this. And the model for this, it's to leverage both public and private money. And the model is one that John will be very familiar with, the Export-Import Bank, which you ran for a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is not a new concept. The Export-Import Bank was created in 1934 as part of the New Deal. And we've already seen at least a couple examples at state and local level. The state of Connecticut and the city of Chicago under Mayor Rahm Emanuel have instituted this at a local level. It wouldn't all be clean energy, but grid improvements, which is a big part of clean tech actually for smart grid and other forms of, you know, we desperately need infrastructure investment and projects and that'll create jobs as well.
Let's get the audience questions involved here. We're going to put a microphone up here and invite your participation. Again, if you are on this side, please go out that door if you can, rather than crossing this camera here. And the line will start with Sarah or Jane Ann, who are right there. And we welcome your participation and encourage you to join us with one part comment or question.
As those questions are being formulated, Greg, something we might want to talk about is the other aspect of our energy lives, and that's transportation energy. Mm-hmm. We talked about it briefly in the context of the Department of Defense, but our addiction to oil, while it is being slightly diminished through the adoption of CAFE or corporate efficiency. Average efficiency, we need to expand the choices of fuel to more electric-powered vehicles or plug-in electrics. We need to have more natural gas vehicles at the fleet level, if you will, delivery mm-hmm. trucks or waste trucks or buses or what have you. And to every percent of our transportation energy budget that we take away from oil, we're that much more secure and that much more prosperous because we're sending a heck of a lot of money out of our economy to pay for our oil addiction, and that's money that could be used for infrastructure improvements like Clint mentioned, or education systems, et cetera.
And spending a lot of our military to protect those supply routes. Let's have our audience question. Yes, welcome to Climate One.
Thank you. My name is Ann DeVero, and thank you very much for your time educating on all us on all these issues. My question has to do with policy prescriptions, not necessarily financial, which is the topic of this, obviously. But if you had your dream, what would be the top three policy prescriptions that would spur the development of renewable energy here in the United States?
My top one would be to have a revenue-neutral carbon tax that would basically help to capture the externalities of each element of our all-of-the-above energy portfolio. And in this case, greenhouse gas production of fossil fuels loses every time when you compare it kilowatt to kilowatt or BTU to BTU with renewable energy. So by putting in a carbon tax that would you'd be able to rebate, if you will, those who were most affected by that turbulence that I talked about, the change from a fossil fuel powered economy to one of clean economy, clean energy economy. That would be number one. Number two, if you did that, and it captured in a good way the fully accounted costs of each form of energy, each element of energy in this portfolio, you could just about eliminate all government subsidies for all forms of energy, fossil fuel, renewable, or whatever, and you'd have a much more level playing field in a free market economy. John, you may have some thoughts about that.
Well, we debated endlessly whether or not the carbon tax was the right idea. Its virtue is simplicity. Having spent the better part of 7.5 years listening to discussions about what to do with the proceeds and having nobody willing to give up their share of it, you get into a whole series of discussions that are the same kinds of discussions that go on in a democracy. That is to say, which values benefit from that? And I guess I come down slightly differently. I guess I think that the cap-and-trade system provides two great values. Number one, the private sector is given a target that it can deal with and time to deal with it, and the resources. The real way to equilibrate this kind of change, in my view, is to permit the various values to compete in and around a cap-and-trade structure. That's the first thing. The second thing I think I would do would be to rewrite some of the climate legislation and some of the environmental legislation in and around what I think now is a much more rational consensus, to Clint's point. We've been going through a process that can only be described in some cases as zealotry. Zealotry on the side of the environmentalists, and frankly zealotry on the part of the of big business and the utilities. I think we're now in a position where we recognize that both of those have values, and I think it would be a wonderful thing if a rational legislature could sit down and actually have the same discussion based on the current understanding and the current players.
Rational legislature. Okay, just trying to catch that. Okay,
yeah. That's the same as clean coal. Yeah. Yeah.
Probably our most controversial policy recommendation in the book is to phase out all energy subsidies over the next 10 years. So the subsidies for renewables would go away as they were taken away for oil, gas, nuclear, and all the fossil fuels. Unlevel playing field. This MLP's Master Limited Partnerships is a great example. This is a vehicle that's open to oil and gas and not to renewables. So it's talk about a not level playing field. Anyway, we think the price of renewables are coming down. Solar, we've seen the dramatic drop recently, coming down in a way that if you really took away all the goodies for all the energy sources, that 10 years out, they would compete and we think beat their fossil fuel counterparts in the market.
Let's have our next audience question. Welcome to Climate One.
Thank you for coming and thank you for inviting me to talk. My name is Gary Latra. The question I have is to comment on the concept of having the Federal Reserve provide funding. Right now the Federal Reserve is buying mortgages, which just encourages urban sprawl.
Printing money for green projects. John Bond?
The Fed is not equipped to be able to do that, in my judgment. I would argue that there's some serious concern whether they ought to be doing what they're doing and whether they would, in fact, be doing what they're doing were it not an election year. When you get into those kinds of market distortions, it's another concern of private capital. If the Fed is buying mortgages, what's the real price at which I, as an investor, can buy a mortgage? How do I know what price to put on a loan that's going to be secured by a mortgage? When you have these policy interventions, it's really hard for the marketplace and the private sector to work it out. I just don't think they do it very well, to be honest.
Let's have our next audience question. Yes, thanks for that question. Yes,
hi, Jerry Fidler. First of all, thank you for bringing up the military. They're a real leader in renewables, and they don't get mentioned often enough. And I just want to suggest that one thing that I think could have real impact on ability to produce energy and also save taxpayer money is giving the military the ability to do longer procurement cycles. One of the issues that they face is they're shackled by Congress, often to 1, 2, 3 year procurement cycles, and you need a 10-year offtake to finance a plant. It would be easier. People don't talk about it much, but it's an easy thing to do, and I think it'd have a huge impact.
It's a great great comment, and in fact, there's been progress. I'm happy to report in this regard. They've gone back to existing legislative authority in the case of biofuels, for example, creating commercial offtake contracts that are looking to be as high as 15 years. They've already adopted the idea of power purchase agreements for the 3 gigawatts of electrical energy from renewable sources that the department wants to get in place by 2020. And that is really another good thing. And it's all about mechanism, as you well know, to create investor and contractor assurance that, no kidding, this I can have this long enough time to recoup my investment and to make some money.
I mean, that's a great example of how, as a nation, we really do need to think more long-term than we do. China does it, Japan does it, Germany does it, and we write about this, how having those kinds of long-term plans in place, whether it's military or, you know, what is our energy future going to be, is really important as we move forward in this century.
Let's pick up on the China question that comes up. We need to touch on that long policy cycles, long investment cycles. Admiral McGinn, China recently launched an aircraft carrier, got lots of attention, and as a symbol of their growing technological sophistication. How is China becoming a big player, driving down prices? Are they going to run away with some of the leadership here on clean energy?
Well, they have a huge economy. They have a huge population. They've got, I would not in 1,000 years trade our challenges for theirs. It really is, it's tough. And they're trying to grow their economy to create jobs. There's a big urbanization push. They're trying to meet their energy needs in a whole variety of ways. You need only travel to Shanghai or Beijing to experience that rapid growth right in your eyes and lungs with the smog. It's incredible. So they're tough challenges. So I think that the magic is for us to do what the United States does best, which is innovation, invention, education, and to work in partnership with the Chinese to create investment opportunities flowing both ways, technology flow. There's been too much emphasis, I think, in the production of solar modules that are coming in much less expensively from China. But when you really think about the whole value chain of actually producing solar power, including inverters and installation and balance of system, I think that you have a different take on how we're doing vis-a-vis China with the production of clean energy. We need to be cooperative.
Can I comment on that? Because I would argue it's a much more complex question than that. You're talking about two different series, two different kinds of economies. I'm old enough to remember when the Koreans put Westinghouse and a number of electronic businesses out of business, where because, for want of a shorthand, state-sponsored capitalism. That's what the Chinese have been doing. The Japanese did it in the 60s. It does, in fact, deal with a number of highly important policy issues. It's not just as simple as saying whether or not the costs are down or not. It's the question of, if you took a macroeconomic approach, the Chinese banks are largely bankrupt if we did an actual analysis of them. They are supported by the government along policy lines. And when you start talking about planning, that is, I would argue, a viable alternative method of moving to where you want to go for a time. And my Republican friends disinherit me when I say this, but the real world is China has done this for a particular series of reasons. They, like the military in our country, can actually make a decision. Democracies have a tough time in accommodating different choices. And there is now a very active discussion worldwide about whether the China model is the one that developing countries ought to use or whether it's the American model. That debate and the intensity of that debate did not exist 10 or 15 years ago.
Thank you, John Bond. Let's have our next audience question. Welcome, sir.
Hi. You mentioned in terms of innovative financing structures the possibility of using like a REIT or a mastered limited partnership type of structure to finance the clean technology space. Do you envision this geared towards any particular subset, like towards residential, purchase of residential systems where they'd have some sort of power purchase agreement, or do you envision this for larger type of implementations or across a vast array?
I think it could apply at many different levels, residential, whether it's aggregated or a company that was doing a whole series of residences, commercial level, think big box stores, for example, and also at the utility level. The whole point is to try to get more investment capital at a lower cost into the renewable energy transition, and I think ways in which we can do that are going to be made more possible, hopefully, after this political season ends and we start going from politics to policy and advancing the business of clean energy.
Just a comment on that. The models that relate to financing residential are really different from financing utility scale and industrial commercial. In the case of real estate that is based on rooftops, you aggregate a whole lot of those and the credit decision is made on the diversification. And that's what you hear when you hear people talking about securitization. You take a whole bunch of receivables. They could be credit card receivables or any other kind of receivables. That's one way to get into the market through a securitized structure. What we're talking about is commercial and industrial and utility scale, and that requires an underwriting of each project. That's more complex. It relates to bigger numbers in terms of production of megawatts and the rest. Both of the MLP and the REIT structure, I would argue, are better designed to deal with the big numbers in securitization, which is, again, a proven technique. We did it at Moody's 25 years ago, is probably where the rooftop is going to go at least first.
Makes me nervous when you say securitization based on some recent history. Another thing I'll mention is that there's some people trying to get crowdfunding into local rooftop solar projects. So you can invest $25, $50, $100 into local projects. And one firm here, Solo Mosaic, recently received regulatory approval to sell that kind of investment to small investors to broaden the funding base and give people more funding options. We got a few minutes left here. Let's address something that was touched on earlier, the myths about green energy. What are the myths about green energy that you'd like to address that you think are off base?
One of the assets that we have deployed beginning in June at ACOR with about 30 content contributing partners in renewable energy space is a wonderful website called energyfactcheck.org. And if you're a Twitter follower, it's at energyfactcheck. It is fact-based, business-oriented, and nonpartisan, but we take on some of these misinformation things, the political football aspects of renewable energy. We're trying to do things like put Solyndra in a really broad context, not to say it was a good thing, but to say it was something that happens when you have a very dynamic, growing new business and new industry. We try to take on myths like renewable energy is entirely dependent upon government investment, or that renewable energy won't scale, or that renewable energy will always be too expensive. And we just put it out there with really objective facts, sources, and everything. So it's intended for journalists. It's intended for staffers at the state and federal level. It's a really good asset to really tell people the truth about renewable energy. And it is a good story. Those facts indicate a very healthy, vibrant, growing industry. Not one without challenges, but one that is unbelievably better than what you hear in the political airwaves.
I think my number one myth is that clean energy can't scale. I think, you know, I mentioned states getting 15-20% of their power just from wind. There was a one weekend in May in Germany, they got 50% of all their power from solar. And that's Germany, not everyone knows this, Germany, not the sunniest spot on Earth, is the world's largest market for solar power. And they had one particularly sunny weekend, and so it just shot up to half the country's power from solar. And, you know, we see this, it's just growing all over the place.
A bit of irony, Clint, Germany's best solar footprint is not as good as America's worst.
Right.
If you draw a line across the latitude, you come out about to Hudson's Bay up in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I've been threatening my friends in Florida to outlaw the Sunshine State until they get serious about solar power.
Right, exactly. But Germany shows you what policy can do.
Germany paid a price for that.
Huge price.
John Bunn. But the government, and they created an industry and a powerhouse, and they paid dearly for it. John Bunn?
Well, not only that, but it almost brought down the Spanish government, the same kind of sort of diving in head first. My myth is that Republicans don't support renewable energy. And somehow the political season has produced the fact that it's the Democrats and the liberals who promote renewable energy, and the Republicans are all hung up on oil and gas and all of that stuff. I'd like to get rid of that myth, because what we're really talking about is time and how to get it done. And the excessive verbiage on both sides has clouded the issue rather than helped. And so I'd like to get rid of that myth.
Well, how about on climate science? Is it a myth that Republicans doubt and challenge climate science?
Well, some Republicans and even some Democrats challenge the science. I don't think that the Republican Party or the Republicans or the Democrats doubt the science.
Well, Mitt Romney's walked it back, and he certainly is not saying things that he did when he was governor of Massachusetts. It's very different now.
Well, this is the silly season, you know.
Wait till we change. We just got to change the Etch-a-Sketch, and it'll be back on board.
But Admiral McGinn, Lisa Murkowski, Republican senator from Alaska, obviously a big extraction state, she wrote a very nice thing about you when you took your new job at president of the American Council on Renewable Energy. She's from an oil and gas state. Where is she on this renewable energy?
She is, I think, the embodiment of all of the above. She's got a good balanced approach. She is a ranking member on the Senate Energy Committee. She's got good common sense, experience-based. So we really enjoy working with Senator Murkowski. I was in Alaska in April. They've got some great opportunities. They pay a tremendously high cost of energy, both for gasoline at the pump as well as electricity, especially in some of the remote villages. Yet at the same time, they've got unbelievably good assets for renewable energy, whether it's a micro hydro or wind or even solar half the year is pretty darn good. And so in tidal currents, so I see Alaska as being one of those states that has all of the above potential, and they're well represented by Senator Murkowski.
On the Republican point, one of the most powerful voices advocating for the elimination of subsidies is George Shultz. Very, very prominent Republican.
We have to end it there. Our thanks to our guest today at Climate One, talking about renewable energy and finance. John Bonn is CEO of the Renewable Energy Trust. Dennis McGinn is president of the American Council on Renewable Energy and a retired vice admiral in the U.S. Navy. And Clint Wilder is author of Clean Tech Nation, How the U.S. Can Lead in the New Global Economy. If you just joined us, you can listen to this and other Climate One podcast in iTunes by looking for Climate One in the iTunes store. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you all for coming to Climate One today.